We're going to get started. If you'd take your seats. We don't yet have a quorum, but the Judiciary Finance and Policy Committee will begin. Today is Tuesday, February 12th. Members, we were going to take Representative Hortman's bill first, but we don't yet have a quorum, so we are going to start with the budget overview from the court. So if you'd come to the table, state your name for the record, and go ahead. Welcome
Good morning.
To the committee.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. My name is Jeff Shorba, and I am the State Court Administrator for the Minnesota Judicial Branch. I'm joined by Judge John Smith from the Minnesota Court of Appeals, who is also President of the Minnesota District Judges Association, and Judge Greg Johnson from Ramsey County, who is the Vice President of the Minnesota District Judges Association, who will be presenting part of our budget request. This afternoon, I plan to give you an overview of the Judicial Branch budget, as well as a description of our fiscal year 14-15 biennial budget request. The Judicial Branch budget is appropriated to the three levels of court here in Minnesota. As you can see from the slide, our fiscal year 12-13 biennial budget is approximately $551 million. The Judicial Branch has also allocated funds for civil legal services programs, and for fiscal year 12 and 13, that total was around $22 million. Those funds are considered a grant pass-through program and are not included in this $551 million total. Once allocated, our Judicial Council is responsible for appropriating money within each of these budgets. The breakdown, the trial court budget is broken down into a number of sub-budgets. In each of the 10 judicial districts, this budget of $327 million funds the trial court employees in each of our 100 court locations across the state, as well as some operational costs within those districts. A central judge budget pays for judge salary and benefits for our 289 trial court judges. We have a central account or overhead budget, and this budget pays for such costs as workers' compensation insurance, unemployment insurance, some centralized functions like our court payment center, and our district infrastructure for technology. There is a drug court budget. The state appropriation for drug courts is in this budget of slightly almost $3 million. The state appropriation right now provides funding for 20 of our 38 problem-solving courts. The remaining costs are provided by grants from the Office of Traffic Safety, Federal Bureau of Justice Assistance, Office of Justice Programs, and the Department of Human Services for a total biennial budget of approximately $9 million. So about $3 million is state appropriation, about $6 million right now is provided through grant funding. The fifth category is mandated services, and these are funding costs required to be paid by the Constitution or statutes in the areas of jury costs, a little over $6 million, psychological service exams, about $8.3 million, interpreter costs across the state, $6.4 million, and then IFP costs, mostly to pay for transcript production in informa pauperis cases, which is about $578,000 biennially.
Representative Paymar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Shorba, just on the problem-solving courts, even though I represent them, St. Paul, and we have problem-solving courts in Ramsey County, I'm just wondering how those courts are distributed geographically throughout the state, and I'm concerned that Greater Minnesota doesn't have access to problem-solving courts like we do here in the metropolitan area. Is it needs-based? Is it population-based? How do you decide?
Mr. Sharma.
Madam Chair, Representative Paymar, there are a number of ways that this is currently allocated, and I think as I mentioned a little bit in my overview, I'll talk a little bit about the next stage with problem-solving courts. Some of it is based on partnerships with counties. So there are some locations where counties have provided funding, which has helped to establish problem-solving courts in those areas. Others has been a grant process. So a number of jurisdictions around the state have applied for grants. Some have been successful, some have not. When we do our state appropriation, we have a process for those courts around the state to apply for funding from the state appropriation. And that is allocated by our judicial council based on things like need, how long have they been in operation, are they losing federal funding. Right now, our drug court advisory committee is working on a process to try to figure out how we could do multi-county drug courts in more geographically dispersed parts of the state. So we're trying to figure out a process for sharing resources across counties, maybe coordinators or other kinds of services, probation services possibly in certain jurisdictions, where we could share them across counties. We're hoping to have that plan put together so that possibly by the next fiscal year or biennium, we might come back with a, or through grants, we might come back with a number as to how we might do that, with the goal, of course, as you mentioned, to have drug courts operating in all jurisdictions within the state. So it is a challenge, and we're trying to work on that plan right now.
Very good. Thank you.
And Representative Paymar, just to let you know, next Tuesday, we're actually also going to hear about specialty courts. We'll spend the day talking about that.
Okay. Thank you.
Please continue, Mr. Sherwood.
The Court of Appeals budget is more streamlined and funds basically three expenses, staff costs, judges, there are 19 judges currently on the Court of Appeals, and a small operating expense budget. Chief Judge Matt Johnson is here in the audience if there are questions about the Court of Appeals budget. The Supreme Court appropriation funds five primary functions located in this budget. The first is Supreme Court operations, which includes the salaries of the seven justices on the Supreme Court and Supreme Court staff, law clerks, judicial assistants, and a small attorney staff in the Supreme Court. The State Court Administrator's Office, which, as you remember from our overview, is responsible for providing for the sort of business side of our courts, infrastructure services to all three levels in the areas of technology, education, finance, human resources, research and evaluation. 80% of this budget funds our central infrastructure to support technology, HR, and finance. The law library receives an appropriation of slightly over $4 million for the biennium. Child support magistrates are funded out of this appropriation. We budget 34% of the costs of child support magistrate services in the state, and the federal government matches 66% of the cost. So,
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've always wondered, I've never seen an itemization of expenditures for the law library, and I'm not an attorney type, so what expenditures, what does the law library do? Is that strictly record keeping? What do they do?
Mr. Sherba.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, a wide variety of services. I'm more than happy to have our law librarian, state law librarian, come and talk a little bit more about that. But obviously, they fund books for the library, having to pay for those services. They also have a number of electronic services now where you can go into the law library, use Westlaw, do research electronically in the library. A lot of their resources are also put online. So you can go online at the library and get self-help and other kinds of services. They have a staff that is partially funded through this appropriation. They also have librarians working in the law library who are funded from the Department of Corrections. They provide law library services to prisoners. So instead of the Department of Corrections having to build up their own law libraries internally within their correctional institutions, staff are funded in the law library to provide those services via letter, usually to do research and other kinds of projects for prisoners. So they're trying very importantly to go as much online as possible. Often as times it's difficult for people to get physically to the state law library. We also have a lot of other parts of state government that use resources from the state law library, people from the legislature, people from other agencies who will come and ask for research or come to the state law library. So it's a pretty broad range of services they do.
Thank you.
Please continue, Mr. Sherman.
The last part of the Supreme Court appropriation is a small pass-through grant program for community dispute resolution grants. This program was established by statute in 1990, and the grants provide funds to nonprofit organizations that mediate small neighborhood disputes under guidelines established by the State Court Administrator's Office. For our 14 and 15 budget request, the Judicial Council carefully considered several worthy projects and initiatives and determined, given the current fiscal challenges facing the state, our requests would center on unavoidable insurance increases and compensation increases for our judges and employees. We understand the important mission that all of you had to try to allocate scarce resources, and we wanted to streamline our request and what we considered our top priorities. So you can see the total branch request for fiscal years 14 and 15 is approximately $33 million, or slightly under 6% of our current base budget. As seen on the slide, the governor's budget recommendation for the judicial branch is the same amount as our request. So what I'm going to do is talk briefly about the first two items of the request, and then representatives of the Minnesota District Judges Association will address the request in terms of judicial salary increases and pension. In your folder, you'll find a more detailed breakdown of our request broken down by the three levels of courts so that you'll have dollar figures at each level for these cost items. In terms of insurance increases, we based our budget request on estimates provided by the Minnesota Management and Budget Office. At the time, as you can see on the slide, employer insurance contribution increases were estimated at 9% starting January 1st of this year, 9.9% January 1st of 2014 and 2015. These estimates may change, and actually late yesterday afternoon, based on some information we heard about the executive branch settlement agreement, these estimates may be changing, so I hope you'll consider this as a placeholder, and we will certainly work with the chair to change any of these numbers if we get final numbers from the executive branch. From what we are hearing yesterday, may go up a little higher in some years and a little lower in other years, so we're certainly willing to make sure you have the most recent estimates on numbers. But these are unavoidable increases. We do not negotiate contracts on our own for insurance. We simply follow what the executive branch negotiates for insurance increases. The second request is to recognize and reward the stellar efforts of our staff who are working on all of the change initiatives I was here talking about during my overview, and trying to make sure we are providing services in a cost-effective and efficient manner. Right now, we are into the fifth year of no permanent salary increases for our staff. During those 5 years, the executive branch contracts have required them to provide step increases for executive branch employees. During this time, we negotiated over two biennium for no permanent salary increases for our judicial staff. The only increase we gave was a one-time lump sum payment in 2012. Because we didn't know what was going to happen with the legislative session, so we were not willing to give any permanent ongoing increases for our staff. Our employees, therefore, continue to fall behind. Well, not only executive branch employees have been getting steps, but we have seen increases just now across the board, increases for executive branch staff that is permanent. So we decided to prioritize this increase for staff. The compensation increase is calculated on a 3% increase for each year of the fiscal year for a total cost of almost $14 million for the biennium. With that, I will turn it over to the judges to discuss judicial compensation.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and go ahead.
I'm Judge John Smith, Fair Hillstrom. I want to thank you for the opportunity to be here. I'm the president of the Minnesota District Judges Association. The Minnesota District Judges Association represents virtually every district judge in the state and the majority of the appellate judges in the state. Over the past year, it came to our attention that our pension was dramatically underfunded. And over the past year, the Minnesota District Judges Association, with the help of Dave Bergstrom from the Minnesota State Retirement System, has worked with us to come up with a solution to that problem and also to address the need for pay raises. These recommendations did not come easily, and they were the product of a lot of work to reach consensus. I'll let Judge Johnson tell you more about the proposal on the pension, but I do want to address the pay issue. The most recent survey of judicial salaries across the United States places Minnesota judges 31st in compensation, 34th if adjusted for cost of living. Judges' compensation in Minnesota has historically ranked in the top half of the country to ensure an ability to attract and retain the best and brightest judges. A 4% increase, as recommended, would move judges up to $134,288.96, or 25th in the country, in other words, mid-range. Judges have not had a pay increase since 2008. This is the longest stretch of time without a pay raise in the last 40 years. Meanwhile, we are asking judges and staff to do more and more work with less and less resources. This pay increase, 8% over the biennium, would actually be less than retired judges get in their post-retirement fund. So there is at least some incentive for judges as they reach retirement to retire, because they make more in terms of increases by retiring than they do staying on the job. And I can personally speak from experience that I have had friends who have made exactly that decision. And what happens when you lose long-term judges is that you lose a vast amount of knowledge, a vast lot of experience that takes years and years to replace. I have heard many times about the need for performance measures in evaluating the worth of agencies and the branches of government. And I would dare say that the judges in Minnesota are probably the most accountable of any branch of government. We have great oversight and have time limits on when we have to have things done, and we've been very accountable in that regard. Nationally, the Chamber of Congress ranks Minnesota fourth nationally in terms of business climate, which I think is a reflection of what a good judiciary we have. I was a district court judge for 21 years until recently being appointed to the Court of Appeals. I can only speak from experience about the hard work and the dedication of the judges in this state. And if you wish to attract and retain the kinds of judges that you'd like to have, then I would ask that you support the pay raise as requested. I would also add that this is part of a package of the pension proposal and the pension fix. I think this is an important step in correcting the judicial situation and making the judicial pension viable in the future.
Representative Paymar.
Sir, I support the pay raise, assuming we have the resources to do that. I guess there's two questions. The 4% increase for judges is predicated on, which I believe the governor supported in his budget, is predicated on the governor being able to get the legislature to agree to his revenue increases. So what is your fallback position if that fails and we simply retire the existing deficit that the state has? And then I'm curious about retention. I mean, do you keep records of judges who have left because $125,000 annual salary plus benefits and vacation, et cetera, is lacking, and that you're actually losing judges because of that package?
Chair Hiltzman and Representative Tapeman, I don't have accurate statistics and wouldn't venture to say that. I can only speak anecdotally about friends of mine who have made that decision, and I know that they've made that decision.
Madam Chair.
Representative Paymar.
You mean to leave,
yes,
and go back into private practice? Or
retire.
Judge Smith.
I there's another part of the question there, and I didn't answer.
Representative Paymar,
Madam
please
Chair.
Go through the chair.
Madam Chair, what happens if we don't have the resources?
Judge
what,
Smith?
Madam Chair, let me finish the question, because the judges are getting a 4% raise and staff are getting a 3% raise. Have you considered any other option that's more equitable towards the staff if that situation were to occur?
Judge Smith.
Chair Hillstrom, Representative Paymar. I think this will be cleared up by Judge Johnson. The 4% increase includes the 1% contribution to the pension plan. So actually the pay raise would result in a net of the same for the staff and the judges. So, and I should add that this was long debated in the Judicial Council, and this proposal was passed unanimously by the Judicial Council, and I think that decision was very deliberate and reflected the needs of the judiciary. I would note that the last biennium we did not ask for pay raises because we didn't think it was appropriate under the situation. We think now that it is appropriate.
Thank you.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I notice you have a National Association of Legal Career Professionals 2011 study here where you find that the salaries, first-year associate salaries are $160,000 at prevailing at large law firms. And you're comparing that to the $120,600 for Minnesota law employees. Do you know what the average law employee makes as far as their other compensation and benefits and health benefits and retirement, all those different fringes? How that compares to the private sector?
Judge Smith.
Chair Hillstrom and Representative Scott. We've looked at that, and I don't have that information available right now, but I certainly can get it to you. We looked at all of those things, and I think we can provide you with a lot of information that shows that this pay request and the salaries for judges is extremely equitable, considering the salaries of attorneys and judges around the country.
Representative Scott.
Well, I guess I wouldn't. Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know that I would expect a lawyer or a judge or someone that works for the judiciary to be compensated equally with the private sector, because I just think of these big powerful lawyers and these large law firms that this $160,000 that study is coming from, and I know what some of these lawyers make big dollars, and I understand it's a sacrifice for most of you to be a judge. It's an act of public service, and I understand that. My other issue that really raised my eyebrow was the whole thing where they could retire and make as much or more than they do currently sitting on the bench, but yet we have a pension problem. So what are we doing to fix the pension problem so that we don't have that scenario? I'm not picking just on judges. That's pretty commonplace for government. A lot of government employees, you hear those stories of people retiring and making more money than they were when they were working. So,
Judge Smith?
Chair Hillstrom, Representative Scott. There are two things that I would say. First, about the salaries. I can tell you that when I left private practice, I was actually making more as an attorney than I was as a judge. I knew that I was making that sacrifice. And over the last 21 years, what's happened is we really haven't even kept up with the cost of living. That's the problem, is that if you look at Social Security percentage increases as cost of living, we're far below that. And all we're really asking is to stay up with the cost of living so they don't lose buying power by staying as a judge. With respect to the pension, that is being addressed in the pension proposal, because we are proposing a decrease in the amount that retired judges would receive. There are a number of fixes for that. I think that this, again, reflects the thought that's gone into this process because it does address all of the things that you're talking about.
Representative Scott. Thank you. Representative Moline.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Judge Smith, since I have you here, and maybe Mr. Shorba or Judge Johnson could comment as well. And I don't want to spend too much time on it because I have a bill up tomorrow addressing some cost of living situations for Court of Appeals judges, and I know that Judge Stauber is going to be here testifying to that. But, you know, just so the members are aware, and Judge Smith, maybe if you could comment, since you're a judge from Greater Minnesota, Walker, if I remember correctly. You know, when we're talking about the cost of living for judges, especially on the Court of Appeals, you know, the way that we have the system set up right now is judges that are from Greater Minnesota are not compensated for their housing in St. Paul. So they're expected to pay out of pocket to serve on the Court of Appeals where they're chambered in St. Paul, while, of course, maintaining their homes in Greater Minnesota, which we don't ask of our own legislators. Most of us wouldn't be able to afford to have a mortgage back home and an apartment in St. Paul, but I think it's important to have that diversity on the court. So I guess I would like to hear, you know, from Judge Smith on that cost of living impact on Court of Appeals judges, and then if there is any proposal from the Court of Appeals to be able to work into your budget a way to actually compensate our judges from Greater Minnesota who serve on the Court of Appeals for their housing expenses in St. Paul.
Judge Smith.
Chair Hillstrom, Representative Lee. I haven't had a lot of opportunity to look at that bill. Of course, being from out of state, I would certainly support it personally. Really, what we're here to talk about really is the overall pay increases and the pension. And I would like to give time to Judge Johnson to talk about that.
Representative Moline.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Judge Smith. And then maybe if, you know, Judge Johnson or Mr. Shorba could comment if, you know, it's a workable proposal within the Court of Appeals budget. From my understanding, there's only four judges on the Minnesota Court of Appeals that live more than 50 miles away from St. Paul. So I don't think it's an exorbitant cost. And I'm just wondering if, you know, it's workable to work into your current budget, or if you would need additional appropriations in order to cover for some housing costs for Greater Minnesota judges.
Mr. Shorba.
Madam Chair, Representative Moline, I'm not an expert, so if Judge Johnson does want to talk about the Court of Appeals budget, I know the Court of Appeals budget is very tight in terms of operational costs. As you probably know, there is statutory authority to pay for up to 2 years of those living costs, which is what the Court of Appeals has budgeted for. So I would think, and Judge Johnson can correct me, that there would probably need to be some additional appropriations. In addition, I don't know if your bill would not only include Court of Appeals judges, but potentially also interest by trial court judges and Supreme Court justices. So we are also trying to look at a fiscal note based on your bill. And I don't really have authority to support or not support it because it hasn't gone through our process yet internally, because we've just notified of the bill. So.
Okay.
And we're going to be meeting with you, I think, later this week to talk about it a little bit.
Representative Moline.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I won't spend any more time on it since the committee is hearing it tomorrow. But the parameters of my bill are just the Court of Appeals, since it is required that there be at least one judge appointed from each congressional district. So it's inevitable that we do have judges from Greater Minnesota serving on the Court of Appeals. But we can talk about that further, and we'll wait for the committee to hear it tomorrow. So thank you.
Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm curious, the interpreters and psychologists, I know that there's been some work done with the technology and so forth to cut down on those costs. I know those were the leading edge costs, cost drivers here about 3-4 years ago, but they may still be in that area. What are you doing to help curb those costs? Are we trying to figure out a way to, I know that there's been fraudulent use of those services in some of the courts and folks I've talked to. Have we been able to get at that in order to make certain that we're only providing services to people who truly need it?
Mr. Shorba.
Madam Chair, Representative Joskowski, yes, we have made great strides, I believe, in trying to curb some of those costs. As I mentioned in the overview, in the interpreter area, we're using not only telephone interpreting, but ITV interpreting to try to reduce those costs. We've hired regionally some staff interpreters who are paid annual salary, but certainly nothing like the travel costs and contractor costs in very popular languages to try to reduce interpreter costs. We're doing the same thing in the psychological services areas. We have hired some staff primarily in the metro who have been able to provide some services remotely if they can for some kind of interviews or other things if they don't have to see somebody in person. And then again, we've been able to cut down on our contractor costs by hiring staff. We also put out sort of a bid for these kind of services with very strict limits on what we would pay and made the contractors compete. They were not happy because they were getting different rates at various districts based on their location, and we put out a statewide bid so that we would be able to control the costs in a way. So I believe we've made great strides in trying to control these costs.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Sharba, so what has happened locally? I mean, I've heard anecdotally directly from the people who work in the courts that there's been fraudulent use of some of these services in the past. Have we... is there anything that we can do to screen to make certain that people using them truly do need them? Or have you not found that to be an issue in the courts?
Mr. Sharba.
Madam Chair, Representative Drazkowski, I have not heard that is a big issue in the courts. As you know, this is a very touchy area. It's a constitutionally protected right. An individual who makes a request, and I certainly have judges here who can help me answer this, but who make a request, it's very difficult to begin testing them as to whether they really need those services or not. On the other end, if you do not provide an interpreter or one is not available within a reasonable period of time, we have been the subject of lawsuits suing us for those kind of inability to provide services. So we try to be very careful in this area because it has not only a lot of advocacy groups, but also the Justice Department comes in and audits us in terms of our interpreter services and can initiate investigations if they are concerned about not providing these services. So I haven't heard that there's a big fraud issue, but I know that we are cautious about how we test people to need those services.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Earlier you discussed that in terms of negotiating or arriving at health insurance amounts and increases, you basically take the executive branch contract number. Can you tell us more about that and how that evolved? And is you obviously you've piggybacked on that, which means that the judges and other employees of the courts are receiving full health insurance benefits with no premium cost to them for their individual coverage. Is that correct?
Mr. Sharba.
Madam Chair, Representative Drazkowski, no, we follow the same exact rules that all other state employees do in terms of premium costs for individuals, whether they have single or family benefits. The only advantage we have is that we are now part of a larger pool of state employees. So what we've been told, and we've had many discussions with MMB about this, Minnesota Management and Budget, is to go off on our own and try to negotiate some kind of insurance cost would be much more expensive for the judicial branch than to be part of this larger pool with the executive branch agencies. So that's what I mean by piggybacking. We don't have any special rates or anything else. We follow exactly what the executive branch employees have.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Sharba. So indeed, then, the policy or the approach is in state government that the state employees do get 100% of their premium paid for by the taxpayer for their individual insurance coverage. If they buy family coverage, that's piggybacked on top of that, and they pick up a cost of that additional part. But their personal coverage is 100% paid for by the taxpayer. So I'm assuming that's what you meant.
Yep.
Thank you. So then the other question is these retirements, and Representative Scott was asking about that. Are there employees in the system or past judges who retire and get these lucrative pensions and then come back and actually still work for the court while they're retired?
Mr. Sharba.
Madam Chair, Representative Drazkowski, a judge who retires from the system can come back to work as a senior judge in the system. They have to be approved by the Chief Justice and be on a senior judge list. And then they have to, of course, be requested by a district to come in and do work within the district. But they can come in and work as a senior judge, and they get paid a daily rate. to do that. Yes.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Shorba, is that, do all districts do that? How common is that?
Mr. Shorba.
Madam Chair, Representative Drazkowski, it depends on number of factors. One is the workload, of course. The second is whether they have some vacancies going on. Right now, it takes a while to get a judgeship filled in Minnesota. There's an interview process. There's an application process. They have to go to the governor. So during that time period, you may have judges who are used to fill in the senior judge ranks. So it really does depend on the workload and what kind of vacancies there might be in a district.
Representative Drazkowski, I do have other folks on the list, so if you've got a long list of questions, to give some others
a chance, Madam Chair.
Drazkowski.
I will follow up with this one, but my last question, Madam Chair, is the $129,000 salary, what does that inflate to when you include the full compensation costs?
Mr. Shorba.
Madam Chair, Representative Drazkowski, I'll defer to my colleagues. I don't know the answer to that. We could certainly find it out, but I don't know what the benefits. Usually the benefits are calculated around 30% of the salary for employees, but I'm not going to be sure about that for judges. So,
Judge Smith?
Chairman Hillstrom, Representative Drazkowski, I don't have that information in front of me. I certainly can provide it for you.
All right.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lesch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a question for Representative Drazkowski. What do you mean by fraud you've heard of and with interpreters? I wasn't tracking how you could do fraud with an interpreter.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, the stories, Representative Lesch, that I have heard is that there are courts and people who work in courts who have recognized people who have come in and demanded interpreter services, and then after they demanded them, apparently there is sometimes a delay in order to get them, so there may be a tactic that's used to delay the process, and then suddenly at some point in the future the individual starts talking in English.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Lesch.
Madam Chair, thank you for the clarification. I understand
what I hear.
No, and I understand.
Go through the chair. Representative Lesch.
I'm not slamming Representative Drazkowski. I can see how there would be that perception for some people, and perhaps it has gone on. From my experience, it is frustrating when you end up having to work with an interpreter, but in a lot of cases, the caution is given to defendants to ensure that they know all their rights, because they may know many words, but the technical words that they need to know in order to enter a plea or actually go through a trial are a lot more substantial, which requires an interpreter. So, I mean, it was just a question regarding that, but thank you for the answer.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It was kind of along the same line as Representative Lesch there. I'd be very cautious, Representative Drazkowski, about using anecdotes. Anecdotes is the basis for judging interpretive services, because that's not the best evidence, I don't think. The district where I represent, it's more diverse now than ever, more people of color than Caucasian. We have Hmong, Latino, Somali, and the interpretive services really give them the access to the justice system that we know we all deserve. So it bothers me that you just kind of throw out that interpretive services are the basis of fraud. I don't think we know anything to that extent at all. In fact, we need those kind of services just to make sure that our constituents get the services that they need and to access the justice system.
Mr. Shorba, I have a question. Mr. Shorba, are interpreters also getting the pay increase, or is that other staff are getting, or just the interpreters that are staff, or what's happening with the interpreter's salary? Mr. Shorba.
Madam Chair. The calculation that we did of this cost is for staff. So if the interpreter is a staff member, there would be an increase. Not necessarily. We have lots of different organizations we get interpretive services from, and those are all negotiated. So it would only be the staff that's included in this number.
All right. Further questions from members? All right. Mr. Shorba, do you want to continue, or is it Ms. Judge Smith? Are you finished? Okay. Judge Johnson.
Thank you. I am Judge Greg Johnson. I'm a judge in the 2nd District, which is Ramsey County.
I'm here to talk about our pension, the judge's pension, and to tell you that the judge's pension is in tough shape. It's currently funded at 51%. And the Minnesota District Judges Association has spent the last 2 years working on a plan to hopefully strengthen our pension fund. This plan that we've come up with requires shared sacrifices from sitting judges, from retired judges, as well as from judges who have yet to be appointed or elected. Every judge, whether they're a sitting judge or a retired judge, will forego some benefit to improve the long-term stability of our pension. There are a number of factors that have contributed to the problem that we have with the pension. First of all, the pension wasn't funded until 1991. So what that means is it was a pay-as-you-go type system. In addition, with the recent recession and the drop in the stock market and other investment opportunities, have hit our pension extremely hard. Essentially, what's happened is that the return on investment for our pension has been significantly lower than what it has in the past. In addition, the legislature changed what's called the return on investment assumption. It was at 8.5%, and it was changed to 8%, which has also had a significant negative impact on the fund. In addition, large payouts took place in pensions during the 90s when the stock market was going great guns and the cost of living increases were significant, and that has come back to haunt the fund as it stands now. In addition, and I think this is a positive thing, judges and their spouses are living longer, but that has contributed to a difficulty with the fund itself because it means that people are collecting pensions for a longer period of time. Our goal, and as I mentioned, we are currently at 51% funded, and if we don't change this, if we don't improve the funding, within 25 years, the judge's pension will be bankrupt. Our goal is to reach 80% funding by 2038, which is a 25-year period. We believe that the plan that we've come up with will accomplish that goal. The proposal comes not only from the Minnesota District Judges Association, but is the Judicial Council as well, and we've worked long and hard with Dave Bergstrom, who's the executive director at MSRS, to come up with this plan. And the plan is as follows: to raise the employer contribution by 2%. Currently, the employer is funding 20.5% of the pension, and our recommendation would be to increase that to 22.5%. Again, we would be asking the current judges who are currently sitting to increase the contribution from 8% to 9%. We would also be recommending a change to the multiplier. Judges currently, our retired judges, those of us who are currently sitting judges, have a multiplier of 3.2%. Our recommendation is to reduce that to 2.5%, which would become effective July 1st of 2013. The new judge contribution then would, in other words, for those judges who are appointed or elective after July 1st of this year, their contribution would be 7% into the pension fund rather than the 9% that sitting judges would be required to pay. In addition, going to the issue of retired judges and what they're receiving, really that what they receive depends upon how many years of service that they have. So each judge, after they retire, has a 3.2% multiplier, but that's based on their number of years in actual service as a judge. What we are recommending is that, and I would point out that retired state employees, including judges, were receiving a cost of living increase of 2.5%. That was reduced, I believe, by the 2010 legislature. So that was reduced from 2.5 to 2%, which is currently what judges are receiving as a cost of living increase. We are recommending that that be reduced to 1.75%, which will be less than other state employees, until the pension is funded at a 70% level. In addition, we're recommending that the age that a judge can retire with full pension, which is currently 65, be reduced to increased to 66, so that if a judge retires before 66, there would be a penalty. As an example, currently, if a judge retires at 65, you're eligible for your full retirement. If you retire, say, at 64, you take a 6% reduction, and for every year that you retire before 65, there's a 6% reduction that's attached to that. So we believe that this is a comprehensive plan. We've spent a lot of time on it. We have the support of Dave Bergstrom from MSRS, and we feel that it will bring long-term stability to the judge's pension fund. And as I mentioned, it will require a sacrifice on the part of current sitting judges as well as retired judges and those judges who have yet to be appointed or elected. So with that, thank you. And I'm happy to try and answer any questions that you might have.
Further questions from members? Representative McNamer.
Madam Chair, is the judge's pension determined on their last high five or their high 5 years of salary?
Wouldn't like that. Judge Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative, it is. It's based on high five as well as with this multiplier in years of service.
And Madam Chair,
Representative McNamer,
did I notice they have gone without a raise for 5 years?
That is, Madam
Judge
Chair,
Judge Johnson,
Representative, that is correct. The judges have not had a pay raise since 2008.
Further questions from members? All right, seeing none. Anything? Any closing? All right,
Madam Chair, there's one thing that I would add, and we don't have the report yet, but the Minnesota District Judges Association has retained an economist who's the chair of the econ department at McAllister College, and she's preparing a report for us. I hope to receive that report tomorrow, but I do know that she is recommending for this biennium in her report, or feels what would be an appropriate pay raise would be 5.8%. Now, we're not asking for that much. We're asking for 4%, but I think that goes to bolster our argument that the pay raise that we're asking for is fair and reasonable.
Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering, those senior judges, any idea what rate they're paid at? And the other part of the question is, could we get a copy of that survey of judicial salaries that you referred to in your handout?
Judge Smith.
Chairman Hillstrom, Representative Druskowski, yes, we can provide that to you.
Mr. Shorba.
Madam Chair, Representative Druskowski, senior judges are paid $351 a day.
Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Next, Representative Hortman is going to present her bill. We officially have a quorum. Carly, if you could.
Thank you, Representative Portman. Would you like to move your bill, House File 278?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd like to move House File 278 be passed and sent to the General Register.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have with me the reviser of statutes, Michelle Timmons, to explain the bill. I think some of the members on this committee were on civil law and heard it there, but I'll let her describe it for you.
Please state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Yes, Madam Chair, I'm Michelle Timmons, the reviser of statutes, and I'm also, by virtue of statute, on the Uniform Law Commission. And so I actually served as the chair of the drafting committee for this act, the Uniform Electronic Legal Material Act. The act was approved by the Uniform Law Commission in July of 2011, and then at the February meeting of the American Bar Association in 2012, it was approved there. It actually had two enactments last year in 2012 in the states of Colorado and California. This year, it's been, well, it was introduced in Minnesota last year and reintroduced again this year. And we also have introductions in Connecticut, Hawaii, Massachusetts, and North Dakota. And as I was listening to the House Rules debate last night, I got an email from my counterpart in Hawaii, where it was a significantly earlier time when he sent his email. Anyway, telling me that it was had gone through a couple of committees in Hawaii and looked like it was moving to the floor and was probably going to be enacted in Hawaii this year. In any event, last year, this bill actually did pass the House 133-0 in Minnesota, but because it was a short session, it did not get a Senate hearing, and so it's been reintroduced this year. Representative Portman is the chief House author with co-authors Representative Scott and Representative Earhart, and the chief Senate author is Senator Latz. And we just earlier this afternoon had the hearing in Senate Judiciary where the bill did pass out of that committee. So, as drafted for Minnesota, the only legal material that is covered in this act is the most important state-level legal material. That is the Minnesota Constitution, the Minnesota laws, or sometimes we call them session laws, the Minnesota statutes, and the Minnesota rules, or administrative rules. And so the revisor's office is the publisher for all of those materials already. So the only official publisher named in this act would be the Office of the Revisor of Statutes. And so then if this is enacted, what my office will do is authenticate those four main types of legal materials. And so someone who is viewing that material on a website will be able to see that it's the authentic material produced by the revisor's office. We also will be preserving that material in either print or electronic format and will be providing long-term public access to the material. And believe me, the public does want access to it. We recently did a project where we scanned the Minnesota statutes all the way back to 1851. And we inadvertently apparently missed some statutory language from 1891. And I received not one but two inquiries, one from a private lawyer and one from a housing court referee, saying, I need those 1891 statutes for my research. Can you please find that material and get it online? So I guess that's anecdotal, but I think it really shows that this type of material, legal material that had the force and effect of law at any time during the state's history, is really still being utilized and accessed today. So if the law is enacted...
Ms. Timmons, sorry to interrupt. Oh, we have a question from Representative Lesh.
Oh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Timmons, you said you scanned Minnesota statutes all the way back to 1851?
Yes.
Which, of course, is pre-statehood. So when we became a state, did we just take the territorial legislature's statutes and make them and codify them as state statutes, or why would you need statutes pre-statehood?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Lesh. Yes, the session laws go back to 1849, and the first codified statutes were then in 1851. And you're absolutely correct. Until statehood, those were the territorial laws and statutes. And so even those we did make, we scanned and made accessible. Many of the territorial statutes did, in effect, they were reenacted, recodified, and became state statutes at the time of statehood.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please continue.
Yes, Madam Chair. So if this bill is enacted, the effective date is January 1, 2015, and the revisor's office already has a beta version of authenticated administrative rules. That is out online already, and I've got the URL there in the handout that I think you just received if you want to go take a look at what we've done. Actually, everything that you see on the revisor's website is encrypted during the transmission. And so we use what's called secure server technology, the same type of technology that a bank would use. And you can see that by looking at the URL at the top where it says HTTPS. That S stands for the extra security that we provide. And then in addition, what we're going to do is we're going to run what's called a hash algorithm, which is a great big long number with 64 characters, on the content of on each and every PDF of the legal material. And then what you'll be able to do will provide a hash reader. So what you'll be doing when you authenticate is you'll be asking the computer to compare the hash value on that document that you're seeing on the screen against the original hash value that we have stored in our main database behind the firewall in the revisor's office. So there will be a double form of security. And this is kind of a homegrown method of authentication. So it will not require us to pay for any additional software or hardware other than what we already have. There's a little staff time involved in the development of this, but we've already done the beta version on the hardest document type. I believe that this is really part of our core mission in the revisor's office and that we'll be able to absorb this work as part of our ongoing budget. We also will continue to work on our preservation plan. Right now, as you know, we still print the law books, and print is a very good backup method of preservation. In addition, we run backup tapes. We have backup tapes here in the Capitol complex, and some are sent out to Coon Rapids. And then after I watched what happened with Katrina, I decided that we had better send some backup tapes a little further away. So the Coon Rapids facility has a sister facility down in Missouri, and we actually are sending backup tapes to Missouri so that we have different geographic locations. We're also working with the History Center and the U of M to look at a project to provide longer term preservation of these electronic materials as a collaborative project. So with that, I would stand for any questions.
Are there questions from members for Ms. Timmons or the author? Seeing none. Seeing no amendments, is there any further discussion to the bill? No? Representative Hortman renews her motion for House File 278 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed? Motion prevails. Is there somebody here from the tax courts to present the budget? Thank you. Please state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Brad Della Pena. I'm the Chief Judge of the Minnesota Tax Court, and with me today is Judge Joanne Turner. Judge Turner and I were both appointed to the tax court in December of 2012. Also with us today is Lisa Peister, the court's long-term administrator. I'll just remind members that The tax court stands as a neutral tribunal in which taxpayers can challenge the actions of government agencies, that is, state and local officials who do property tax assessment, and also the actions of the Commissioner of Revenue. We have 98% of the docket as property tax cases and 2% as Commissioner of Revenue cases. We've asked for some increases this year. I just want to remind you of some numbers. In fiscal year 2000, the tax court's three judges and three staff handled 1,300 new filings. In 2010, the tax court's three judges and three staff had just short of 6,000 filings. So there's been no increase in the staff of the court, number of judges since 2000, and we've had approximately a five-fold increase in the caseload. With that increase in caseload has come substantial filing fee revenue. It moved from about $150,000 in 2000 and now stands at approximately $1.5 million. That's annual filing fee income. The court's budget in fiscal year 2000 was $717,000. It's now $825,000. So you see that there is a substantial increase in filing as well as revenue coming into the court. And with that, I'll turn it over to Judge Turner.
Members of the committee,
please state your name for the record and go ahead.
I'm Joanne Turner, and as the chief indicated, I'm one of the newest appointees to the court. Again, it's a three-member court. Our request, the governor's budget request, includes an increase of $161,000 for the court. That covers three items. It covers two full-time law clerks to be shared among the three judges. They would be paid at the same rate as is paid to a district court law clerk in the state, and that's total salary and benefits about $65,000 per clerk. It also includes payment for a contract with Westlaw for electronic legal research, something the court has never had access to. That's about $6,000 a year, and that funds access for three judges and our staff and any law clerks. Westlaw prices by the number of judge IDs issued. Although we have unlimited access to certain libraries for that, we do not have unlimited users. We have unlimited usage, but not unlimited users. So it would fund three judges' access plus our clerks. And finally, it includes money for professional education and training for the three judges, specific to valuation of property, which, as the chief indicated, is 98% of our load. And for that, we'll stand for questions.
Questions from members? I represent Paymar.
If I may clarify one point, Madam Chairman. The request does not cover any increases in compensation for staff. It does not cover insurance increases. It's our understanding that those were built into the governor's overall budget. Also, the pay for judges on the tax court is by statute a percentage of the pay for district court judges. So if there is an increase in district court judge compensation, that's not included in this request.
Further questions from members? Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just wondering that those numbers again, 1,600 cases 5 years ago, and then is there kind of a national standard that the tax courts go by in terms of the number of cases per court or per judge?
Judge De La Pena.
Madam Chair, Representative Drazkowski, I think the judicial branch has studies, and the average caseload for a tax court judge at this time is in the neighborhood of the average caseload of a district court judge. With the current number of filings, let's just assume that 2010, which was just shy of 6,000 filings for the three judges, that's a high watermark. We think the number is going to go down to somewhere between 4,500 and 5,000 and probably stabilize there. So we're talking about 1,600 to 1,700 cases per year per judge, and I think that's consistent with what we're seeing in the district courts. And I'll simply point out, by way of justifying the request, that district court judges will have between one and two law clerks to manage that kind of caseload. To date, we have no law clerks. And so I think so that we can provide the service to taxpayers that they deserve for the filing fee, we'd like to get that kind of support and see if we can both bring down the case, the number of cases that we have on the court's docket, so that at some point we're retiring the number of cases that are filed. So that's a kind of a two-step process.
Further questions?
Thank you, Judge and Madam Chair.
Members, I just wanted to let you all know that you have expanded information, budget information, that is in your folder. Make sure you take those and put those in your budget book. And with that, we have nothing else, and this meeting is adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Scott.
Madam Chair, did you approve the minutes?
We did not. We'll do it next time. I already said the meeting was adjourned. Oh. Thanks.